Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another show of At Home with Victoria, with your host, Victoria Gaither, and co-host, Michael Kay.
Everyone. Well, every time you hear that music, you know you're listening to At Home with Victoria. I am Victoria Gaither, television journalist and host, and also joining me, Michael, you could say you're my radio husband, Michael Kay.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I've earned that. I've earned that. And welcome back, my lady. It seems like it's been eons since you've been home.
I know. Well,
I
was on vacation in Orlando, Florida last week, my first time visiting Disney World, and I had actually had plans on doing the show, you know, Michael, while I was there, because, of course, you know, we can do our show anywhere in the great United States of America. That is, unless your cell phone service is working. And, you know, I had to go outside just to talk to you, and I basically had to hold one arm up and have my legs crossed and try to talk, and it was a mess. So I thought, this is not going to work. So that was why I was absent last week. But a few observations, Michael, about Disney World, and, of course, we will put that on our list of things for you and I to do and places for you to visit. The most beautiful manicured lawns and landscape you have ever seen in your life in Orlando, Florida. And what's amazing about Disney World is that, like, you really, of course, don't have to be a kid to go there, because we did Epcot Center, Universal, Gatorland, and a bunch of other stuff. Like, you really do get wrapped up into that happy feeling when you're there. You know, all the people that work for, they refer to it as working for the mouse, for Mickey Mouse. All the people, the staff, you know, the hotels, I mean, everybody's just really on one accord, just really nice, and, you know, just makes you feel like you're a princess and anything that you need. So they really do a great job of making you feel like you're in this sort of wondrous, happy place and happy feeling and land that it really was wonderful. So by the time I got ready to go, I actually felt kind of sad. I was like, wonk, wonk, now I got to go back to my regular life. No more happiness. I'm leaving Disney World now. But it was a lot of fun, though. It was a lot of fun.
I'm sure it would be. And, you know, Disney is on one of my places to probably never go to. I'm just with all the children
No.
running around. And, you know, I am happy No. enough. If I'm happier, my head will explode.
No, I'm telling you, it's not. It really isn't what you would think, because I thought the same thing. I'm thinking, of course, anyone that knows Michael and I know, we don't have children. We have our niece and nephew. That's kind of our limit. I thought, oh,
absolutely.
Great. These kids are going to be everywhere. They're going to be whining all over the place. They're going to be stepping on my
dirty
toes.
Dirty and sticky. And
yeah, like, you know, popcorn and dropping soda all over me. Dude, I have to tell you, there were kids there, but that is just simply not the case. I don't know if it's because of the way the place is laid out, or I don't know what it is, but that is just simply not the case. But anyway, speaking of kids, I know, Michael, because we've been talking about this even before the show, if you've been watching the news, all of us are just shocked and horrified and saddened by the bombing in Boston at the marathon and the 8-year-old kid who died as a result of the bombing breaks your heart.
Yeah, I know. It was horrible. And actually, the story that I was reading was on the Huffington Post, and it reported that basically the father was edging up. Oh, this is going to get me. The father was edging up on the finish line and basically reached down, gave the kid a hug, picked him up pretty quick, and put him back down, and was running away when the bomb went off. And I thought, wow, talk about an absolute tragedy, or about the runner who actually lost both of his legs due to such senseless violence, Vic. I don't know what's happening in the world.
Yeah, it is, you know, it is just absolutely horrible. But, I mean, I know every single agency is, I'm 100% sure, working very hard and trying to figure out who did it. So, you know, we're going to continue to watch this as everybody. In fact, Michael, I don't know if I can make this happen by tomorrow, because we have a show tomorrow also. There's a friend of mine who used to work with me in television named Jamie, who actually lives in Boston, and I know a lot of times she would actually go to the marathon. So I'm going to try to email her when we're done with this show to see if she was there, and if so, if she can call into tomorrow night's show and give
That's
us her thoughts and observations on what she saw, if in fact she was there. So I'll be working on that when the show is over. But with that said, tell us a little bit about our show tonight. Who's on?
Tonight, actually, I'm very, very excited. John Birch is joining us. He's one of the founders. He's the founder of thebizraiseyourgame.com, here to go ahead and tell us how to make our small business as effective as one who's actually funding and producing revenue. So many of our guests, Vic, have been on with their own home-based business, and I think John will give us some really good tips on how to go ahead and avoid some of the pitfalls in early business startup. And then we're going to go to our favorite channel, HGTV. Stephen Aaron is here from the new season of Selling LA. He's new eye candy, and I've been on his site, and the man represents some mighty, mighty fine homes. And so we get to talk to him, as well as listen throughout the show to the music of Andy Crawford. He's actually been touring a lot, and he's so tired he's calling in from his bed tonight, he reports. So that's doing it the old school style.
We'll
but
take it.
Before we do anything, I wanted to very proud. I got this music around 3 o'clock this afternoon. This is Drew Stevens' brand new worldwide premiere of his song Forever. During the song, go ahead and visit him at drewstevensmusic.com and feel free to go ahead and press the free download button. He's got another copy of Neon Moon, a cover from Brooks and Dunn, so he's going to go ahead and give that to you too. So let's open up with the worldwide premiere of Drew Stevens' Forever, and when we get back, John Birch is in the house. Don't go away.
Watch it all unfold.
with Forever. Go ahead and get your free download at drewstevensmusic.com. Joining us right now, John Birch is going to teach us how to be rich forever. John Birch, thank you so much for coming on to your first visit on Unlimited Victoria. How are you, buddy?
Michael, I'm great. How are you?
I am fantastic. I'm a little sweaty. It's almost as warm as it is in Santa Monica here in Delaware, so I'm digging the heat.
Yeah, you know, it's about time to take off the winter clothes and embrace, well, it's spring and then eventually right around the corner summer, so I'm fully ready for summer. How about you?
I can't wait to take the carver off the pool and have a little fun. So
sounds good.
Let's go right to you, buddy. Air Force veteran turned executive consultant. Did you wake up wanting to run your own business?
No, it is the school of hard knocks actually got me to this point. And it's one of the reasons that I think a lot of my clients connect with me is because my first business almost failed.
Really?
And I was able to turn it around to where it was actually ranked the second best business of its kind. I was running martial arts schools at the time. It was ranked second best business of its kind in the world, and I was 22 when that happened. So I kind of reverse engineered my process, and then I had a couple of people who trusted me enough to let me play around with their business a little bit, and they took some of my crazy advice. And lo and behold, they started seeing the results that I saw, which was improved business. And I kind of never looked back.
Wow. Were you schooled prior or just a school of hard knocks?
No, I have a degree in electrical engineering.
Okay.
And I think that what works or what transfers from electrical engineering is an analytical approach, gathering data, non-emotional with it, although it is very emotional when you're in it, and I understand that with my clients also, but just kind of breaking things down into chunkable standard operating procedures and systemization, making sure that you're analyzing the right data points to give really effective tools that bring a return on investment for my clients.
Yeah, Vic, I think it's a little bit more like Tabitha's Salon Makeover or Ramsey's Kitchen Nightmares.
You know, it's interesting, I'm actually doing something like that next week in Orange County, and we're filming it. And people are bringing me into their business for 2 days to do that. This is like the 22nd time that I've done it in the last 7 years.
Wow. Well, I wanted to ask you now that we're speaking of that, when you actually do go into a business, because, of course, you have a set of fresh eyes, so to speak, when you're looking at things. Is it difficult when you can see what's wrong, but the people who own the business or run the business can't see what you see, and they have a hard time taking your advice? Because I imagine when I watch a lot of those kind of shows, it's like the viewer sitting there, we can see it, and it's very clear to us, you know, this isn't working for you, you really need to do something different, but they're so hesitant to change.
Yes, that's actually a skill that I've grown my business to be large enough that I'm not the only person who's doing this. I actually have subject matter experts, people who I transform their business, then they learn my system, and now they're actually part of my team coaching other people on how to transform their businesses. So it's actually one of the hardest things. What you're talking about is having this deft touch with your client to know what's the appropriate tool for the person based on where they are and the response that they're giving you. And I can't want it worse than them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't force it. I can't rush it. It's a process. It's similar running a business from something that's maybe barely making it to something that's good, or something that's good to great, or even barely making it to great. It's a process that it's not dissimilar to learning how to play a piano or dance.
Mm-hmm.
Or writing or art. It's all a process, and you can't rush it.
Wow. What would you say going into a business would be, say, the three biggest pitfalls as to why some businesses work and some businesses don't?
I would say that one of the biggest ones is that somebody thinks that most small business owners are people who are passionate with what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that passion actually becomes kind of blinding, and they think that the passion will carry them over. So that's one of the first things,
right?
Is that people are approaching it thinking that the passion will get them there, and passion is only part of the equation. It is a respect for the other side of the coin is very important, and that is the systems and the service and the vision and the stick-to-itiveness and the analytics. They think that because they could, a person thinks that because they could teach other people how to dance really well, that people should be beating down their door, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I would say, so that first thing is overvaluing passion or their
right.
passion and undervaluing the standard business side of it. Another thing I would say is that there's a saying that I heard 25 years ago, and it kind of stuck with me, and that is, the saying is this: your I will is 10 times more powerful than your IQ.
Oh, very good one. Absolutely.
Wow.
And a person who has the moxie and the spine to say, I will do this, is another thing. I see a lot of business owners, they come up to one problem and they throw their hands up.
Mm-hmm.
Or things don't quite go as planned, or there's a disruption in the marketplace, and
right.
that's it. It's you know, their business is over to them in their head. When,
yeah.
guess what, that's business every day. Every day there's challenges. Somebody's trying to come into your space, your marketplace. The vendors are going to charge more. You're not going to make as much profit. Your clients are leaving. They're coming in. Their staff, you know what I'm saying? This is business.
Yeah. No, and I think, too, that there is a standard formula to a money-making business, a profitable business. I worked for the Elizabeth Arden Corporation for 20 years in the upper management capacity, and I'll tell you, the formula does work if you apply the numbers correctly. Where I think corporate gets it wrong is it becomes everybody's a number, and then they try and do this backhanded we're all family thing. And I think, when it comes to the desire of your workers, they have to be, you know, provided with the same information all the way around. Loretta Lynn always used to say that you either be first, be the best, or be different. And I think a lot of business owners tend to not, I agree with you about the passion, to be too passionate to go ahead and, see that in the way. Vic, I know we have a lot of business people going on. There are some people you should meet, John. I would like to introduce you to the Tam Hush Lees. I think Vic would be a really good a really good person. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I was thinking, Michael, as you were saying that, because, John, I want to say it was a couple of years ago, every December, Michael and I always try to focus on small business. In fact, At Home with Victoria won a little award from Cheryl Woods for our work with small businesses, because we sort of did this thing where we had talked about, you know, shop your local small businesses before you shop the local mall. And so we're very, very pro-small business here at Home with Victoria. But just the amount of people that Michael and I have been able to connect with through our show out of Washington, D.C., Philly, New York, all over the place. And I was and I still am amazed in this day and age that you still have so many people that have the American dream to own their own business, because somewhere I think, you know, me as a journalist, I get jaded sometimes, and I think, oh, nobody really wants to do that. Do people really care? Do they really want to do that? They just want a regular government job and a 9-to-5 and get their little vacation days off and 2 weeks in here and there and blah, blah, blah. But I was just pleasantly surprised, you know, just through our show, the amount of people, whether they come here from other countries or whether they're, you know, born and raised here, that sort of spirit of the American dream is still alive to have your own business. But then the flip side to that is, and John, you probably know better the statistics than I do, you know, the government and different organizations are always releasing statistics about, you know, the number of people that will try their hand at having their own business, and then they end up failing at it. So it is a whole sort of interesting dynamics there when it comes to small businesses, I think.
Yes, I'm a super, super, super big advocate of small business ownership, and I do it with I want to nurture, and then I want to also shake small business owners as well to say that if you are going to go into the fray, it's very similar to stepping into the ring with the boxer. You're
yeah.
going to get hit,
mm-hmm.
and to tell them anything else is to do a disservice. Now that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. But you should go in knowing this is going to be challenging. And I believe that, I mean, some of the statistics of small business ownership in the mid-90s, it was the lowest that it's ever been. It was down to 11% of Americans had their own business, 11%. That means that 89%
wow.
of people were employed by someone else, another company, a larger company.
Wow.
It's up to around 30% right now. Unfortunately, a majority of the people who own small businesses are still, there's only one employee, and that's them. So, and one, Victoria, one of the things that you mentioned, I'd like to touch on because I think it's relevant for this conversation. Kind of that whole eye-opening thing is that, you know, having a small business close is could be a sign of a competitive marketplace, and also could be a sign of poor systems or a poor product. I want as many small businesses to succeed that give a amazing product with an amazing experience. And I think that just because you open up your doors, you turn on your lights, if you expect that you're going to succeed just for doing that, then you are going to eventually close your doors.
I think a lot of small businesses too, again going at it with the vim and vigor, are hilarious. Talk about the biz, raiseyourgame.com, because all this information, the website's fantastic. It's very easy to maneuver around, and tell us a bit about that.
Thanks. We primarily write content and deliver content weekly, several times a week, that is designed to be digested by any small business owner. A majority of my clients are in the fitness profession. However, I have some clients who teach children music. I have some clients who teach martial arts. I have some clients who own salons. So small business owners who have some type of high-touch, high-value product will get a lot out of this. And we try to give something that is digestible, 400 to 600 words of some type of wisdom from either myself or someone on my staff. And, you know, we get about 25,000 small businesses going to it every month.
Fantastic.
That's excellent.
Wow.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
You know, and John, Michael and John, what that also just made me think about was, and John, you can probably speak to this, but the importance of the internet and also social networking, because back in the day, you know, you literally – had to hire someone like you, and you physically had to sort of get on an airplane or get in your car, you know, to go to someone's office to talk to them about this. And I'm sure you still do that and people do that. But I guess my point was the internet and having your own website just, I think, makes you more accessible to other people so that, you know, we're able to kind of dig into your brain inadvertently through your website and try to, you know, get bits and pieces of information. So I know that that in itself is probably – wonderful, you know, just for you to be a resource for people out there. If they're, let's say they're Googling something about business and your website came up, I mean, I think that's just great, you know, with technology to be able to help small businesses and people as well just to get information.
Definitely. I believe that one of the factors for the rise in small business ownership is because of the internet. You know, the biggest invention or creation in the 20th century that affected small businesses was the actual the freeways going coast to coast. That allowed people to travel, commute, etc. Well, that highway right now is the internet, and that really has, after the bubble of 2001-2002, We've seen a lot more stable businesses, and I have clients actually all over the world. I have clients that I consult with in Australia, and we do it via Skype. So I'm definitely very thankful. I do most of my business from my home, and it's really nice actually.
Yeah, let me just go ahead and touch on this a little bit. I watched a movie on the Hallmark Channel called Tom, Dick, and Harriet, and it was about ageism in the workplace. And just to mention that I don't know the exact number about businesses being started by, you know, people, say, our age, in our 40s, kind of a thing. But, you know, people who have their jobs, they've been lost by downsizing or what have you and everything, now there's a whole new marketplace that is becoming excited because the anonymity of things like Facebook and Twitter makes people very comfortable. And because of the word of mouth, I think it's easier to go ahead and get a product endorsed by, say, your friends, in quotations, because it's everybody liking the same thing. Would you agree?
Definitely. I believe that it levels the playing field. I also like the internet and social networking tools because it doesn't take a lot of capital. And
yeah.
I'm an advocate of bootstrapping. And you could do an incredible amount now because there's so many things at your fingertips that you could do online, social networking, that you don't have to do a lot. And there's even products. There's even things. I helped a person create an online product a year ago, and it's making him $75,000 a year automatically every single month. It makes $6,000 to $7,000 a month, $75,000 a year, and it's an addition to his business. And I just really love that because before you couldn't do that. You couldn't create with nearly nothing. Could you create something? And now we can do this. I mean, my business itself, I think. The total amount was like the first month was $80, and I got my business running 7 years ago. It was like $80 because I just needed I needed to get a website. I needed to do this. I needed to do that. Small stuff, $80 invested, and now it's definitely making a very good profit.
Yeah. Do you watch shows like Shark Tank, John?
I do.
What do you think of that?
I think Shark Tank is one of the better shows that's out there. I watch Shark Tank. I watch Bar Rescue, Restaurant Impossible, Tabitha's Takeover. I watch those shows. I think that some of them could be very, very produced, and then I think some of them like Shark Tank because it's set right there, and there's no super editing, and there's no acting, and they come there and they pitch an idea. I think that's really great. I think. It is probably better for the investors than it is for the people coming looking for the funds. But it's always been like that.
Yeah, Vic, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but my biggest fun game is when the unknown people come in with an attitude, they would like $300,000 for a 5% stake in the business, and then they have a couple offers, and then they go for the greed. The greed will never make money in the long run. Wouldn't you agree, John?
I definitely agree. There was actually an episode last week where a guy came in and a woman, he wanted $90,000 for 5% of his company, and then someone offered him $900,000 for 30%, and then he just kind of lost it after that, and he almost lost all of his deals and ended up with only $90,000. I think those are cautionary tales, someone like getting too greedy. What I've seen though is that there are very few. If you watch Shark Tank closely, there are very few really good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Like something that's going to make you like a good idea has to be something that makes you stop and say, "Huh, oh wow, why didn't I think of that?"
Yeah.
And we don't see enough of those. And I kind of like this is a little bit of a call to action for small business owners is be impressive. You have to be smarter than you. You have to be much smarter than you think you are, because there's somebody out there who's in your space who is coming up with the next version of Facebook in your marketplace,
exactly.
In your space.
Yeah.
And you have to and you have to understand that, and you have to kind of accept that, or and be happy accepting that. I 7 years ago when I kind of got into this space. There were six or seven other companies who were kind of trying to do it at the same time. I didn't worry about what they were doing. I just wanted to give the best experience that I could for my clients. I have somewhere around 200 or 300 thank you emails and testimonials. I don't ask for them. People just send them to me. And things such as, I get to spend the weekend with my family. Thank you.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's powerful.
And
John, I want to just because I feel like I'm about to lose my thought and I'm bursting at the seams when
go ahead,
you and Michael were talking about Shark Tank. I watch it every now and then because my sweetie will happen to have it on, and he's a doctor and a business owner and owns urgent care centers in our area. So, you know, that's kind of one of the shows that he loves to watch. And what's interesting from my point of view when I watch that show, I always find myself getting irritated with the people that are there to give the inventors capital. So I guess whoever the panel is, I don't know all of their names, the men and women that are there that kind of shoot those questions back off at them. I always get annoyed at them because I kind of feel like, you know, they're basically just sort of sitting there, and not that they're stealing these people's ideas when they come on the show, but they're just kind of there for the picking because they're the ones that's got all this money, and it really is all about them. So, you know, and I could be completely wrong with my observation on that, but it just struck a chord with me when you said that really that show doesn't necessarily benefit the people that are coming on there trying to pitch their product, but rather it really benefits those investors who's sitting there. So for me, you know, personally, that kind of screams loud at me the numerous times where I've, you know, kind of had it on and I was sort of forced to sit there and watch it because I'm always yelling back at the television screen saying, you know, you don't need this guy. You know, can't you go somewhere else and find somebody else to get what you have to get done the way that they're talking
and,
to
and
you?
And, Victoria, what you if I could interject here, what your,
sure.
you know, that is the position that they're putting themselves in, and for not bootstrapping it, not having better profit margins, not having the connections, and, you know, basically the person who's, you know, the inventor is coming there, and, you know, it's not always just about the funds, it's also about the connections, and the person's inventiveness. And most of those people are self-made millionaires and billionaires, and they, you know, actually all of them are. And
mm-hmm.
there is something unique about that. Now, do I think that most of them get a better, like, is it? It's famous that Mark Cuban always comes in. Somebody asks for 10%, and he'll counteroffer with, "Well, I'll give you the same amount, but I want 33%."
Right.
And he always does that. And rarely do you see him back down. And if the person makes the deal, then they make the deal, and that's what they need. They need that capital to get to the next level. Sometimes you have to give a little bit of equity to get those funds to move stuff, to facilitate, to go faster, to hire a sales staff, and that's the deal that you make. Now, you know, one of the, you know, the Facebook, you know, their initial angel investment was for $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
Could Facebook have done it? Could they be where they are right now without that $500,000? Maybe. They might have been able to, but it would have been a lot longer. It would have taken a lot longer to get to where they wanted to go. And what happens during that time lag is it's a missed opportunity. Your staff, if you can't pay your team, then they're going to leave you.
Yeah.
You know, people are not going to wait around for your dreams to be built. So there is some impetus to kind of get it done. And so, you know, I anyone who goes in there, make sure that your idea, like if there's anyone listening right now and they have a really great idea that they want to take on Shark Tank, make sure it's amazing. Make sure you know your numbers. Don't overvalue your company. Also, don't sell yourself short by just taking the first offer that they have. And have some history. I get really one of the things that really upsets me is when people go on there, they value their company at something really, really high, and they've never sold one thing.
Right.
That gets me.
Yeah, and I really think that the entire panel of Shark Tank does everybody a service because, quite frankly, I've watched it sitting there thinking, that is the stupidest idea I've ever seen in my life. I can't believe they even made it past the screeners. But, John, we're running out of time here. You can find all of John's good business advice at thebizraiseyourgame.com. Where else can we find you, John?
That's it for right now. I am writing a book. So we're trying to come up with something that kind of takes my perspective and applies it to a broad general sense, not only for business, but also for kind of managing your life.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be when you face your demons down at business that you find it really easy to go out and conquer other areas of your life also.
Yeah,
and potentially maybe on TV.
Great. Well, we'll be watching for you. Make sure to go ahead and keep us in the queue and At Home with Victoria is your home, too, all the time. Come on back. We'd love to go ahead and have you, and we'll be keeping our eye on you. All of the posts and chat are up in chat. And, John, thank you enough for taking the time out.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it, buddy.
It was great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you so,
thank you
much.
So much.
Wasn't he a nice guy, Vic?
Yes, he was.
Good salt,
and you know,
good information.
And you know what I love about when we have people like John on? Like you said, he's in the process of writing a book. So, of course, it's like, oh, well, you'll have to come back when you release the book and tell us how we can get it and all that good stuff. So that's one thing I love about our show, that people, when they come on, they really don't just come on one time. It's kind of like a lifelong relationship with us. We're kind of like one of those relationships, Michael, with guests that you get into and we don't let you out. We keep
absolutely.
You trapped.
Sort of like supervised stalking. But I certainly see that the hottest new thing on Selling LA is actually up in queue.
Woo-hoo!
Steve, Aaron, we're going ahead and finding us. We're going to listen to a little bit of Andy Crawford, The Way You Lie, when we get back. The sexy Steve and Aaron.
Whisper softly on my skin, call me off guard. Now I'm listening for the beat of your heart in perfect time. Let every beat of your heart with mine, and I love the way you lie when you. And I love the way you lie to me. Crumbling, I found the bottom again. Hands over my heart to see if it's still beating. And just the thoughts, but in perfect.
Goodness, he was yelling at me. He wanted me to lie to him so bad. But the person I know that will never lie is Stephen Aaron, because
Steven.
He's a trustworthy little fellow. Hello, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you?
Fantastic. Where are you calling from tonight?
I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
You lucky, lucky fellow.
My hometown.
Congrats on
my
the
hometown.
Show.
What's that? I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Congrats on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, very much. I'm a native Angeleno, born and raised. I've never lived anywhere else in my whole life. So it's, you know, I'm on my my stomping grounds here.
Absolutely. This is your first season to Selling LA?
It's actually season three. We had season one and two last year, and season three debuted in February, and then we have season four coming up in the summer.
Yeah, because Vic and I are big HGTV fans, and I caught one of the episodes of you trying to sell a 70s house with a bathroom that looked like it was transported from a time machine. It was the blue bathroom.
Yes,
and I thought,
that was
wow,
in
I'd love to see how you're making
yeah,
this
that,
one work.
That was an all-original bathroom from the 1930s.
Wow.
That house was a total time warp.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, Stephen, what's interesting about houses in your industry that I find is that, you know, what's weird to one person, another person who may like vintage stuff or something may love that house. So, I mean, it really is when it comes to houses, you know, it is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, you know, L.A. is a very interesting city, which mostly was developed in the 1920s and 30s. So there are a lot of amazing character homes, Spanish homes, English homes. The post-war homes that were built were generally in the hills, in the Hollywood Hills. But even there's so many character-rich homes, and that's something that I've always, always loved. You know, I used to be an interior designer before I was in real estate, and one of my favorite classes when I went to the Fashion Institute and got my degree was the history of architectural interiors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just love architecture, and I love, you know, helping sellers bring out the features of their architecture, and then working with buyers really matching their style, their likes to a certain style home. So that's actually a real fun part of my business.
And you know, Michael and Stephen, I was just thinking, and I think that the older I get, the more I actually can appreciate, you know, a older home that's got that, you know, that beautiful wood and mahogany wood, because I remember when I was fresh out of college at American University, you know, my house was your sort of traditional American house where you had the couch and the wood and, you know, what those homes look like. And I remember thinking, I want nothing to do with this. So I went modern. I wanted every single thing modern. I wanted sleek. I wanted simple. I wanted nothing to do with that. So now I've noticed what's crazy. As I age, it's like I feel like I kind of find myself going back to wanting that really nice wood and stuff. So it is weird, I think, how, you know, people just change also in your taste, you know. So we're constantly evolving in our taste as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that, you know, it's interesting because real estate is a reflection of life. And when someone is buying or selling a home, it's usually because there's something going on in their life that's precipitating a change. So, you know, it's as you change and as you evolve and as the circumstances in your life evolve, then it really creates a certain dynamic being a real estate broker where you're really helping people get to that next place, whatever that next step in the evolution of their life. Sometimes it's positive. Other times it's there's difficult reasons. I mean, you have birth, death, divorce, job loss, job gain, more money, less money, you know, kids going off to college. So it's really a reflection of life, and that's an aspect of the business, helping people get from A to B is been an exciting part of my career.
Yeah, John was up talking about too about working with people who divine or not divine place value on how passionate they are about something. And I've certainly seen enough of those shows to know that, number one, a character home means knob and tube wiring, copper piping, and a bad sewer. That's what that means immediately to me. And I'm all for the new construction. But your price market in there, what is the average home that you're actually selling for on a regular basis? Because I know,
well,
L.A. is a market that is a monster onto its own.
Yes, I mean, the average price point of a home in our market is around $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Is really
and that's
where,
for a modest home, so to speak.
Yeah, that's for a modest home. Let's say a two or a three bedroom house in a nice location, and then it goes up from there. So, you know, when you're selling a home that's done, that has a lot of style, it's anywhere from $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million, $8 million, and then up from there you get into the Hollywood Hills. We're actually closing on a deal where we sold a property for $1.8 million, and you know, it's a three-bedroom house with a pool, and you know, nothing that's really extravagant or luxurious, but something that's very stylish in a great location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I find equally stupid selling New York. Some of the prices in New York that I'm looking at too for a 960 square foot apartment,
mm-hmm.
and that's going for 13.7. Granted, it's
mm-hmm.
Midtown Manhattan, above the 80s, but it's just it amazes me how much property has increased and decreased. Your market right now in LA, would it be a buyer's market?
No, now it's a seller's market.
Really?
In the last 4 to 6 months, the tides have really turned and the market has shifted where we have low inventory and a lot of buyers out there. So you have few homes for sale. You have a lot of people out there, a lot of people with cash. Money is cheap. And if you have a good property that you priced right and that you've presented well, you're going to have multiple offers. We had a house that we sold in the little Holmby area that we had 24 offers on. Another one in the Hollywood Hills we had 20 offers on. And so, you know, we're really experiencing a certain velocity to the market that we haven't seen since about, you know, 2006.
Hmm.
Yeah,
and
you
so
know that I'm sorry, I was just thinking about that because Michael and I interviewed another young lady who is actually a real estate agent in D.C. who tonight at 10 o'clock is going to be on House Hunters, and she'll
mm-hmm.
be joining us tomorrow night on our show as well. But I was telling her when we went to sell, and this is in the state of Maryland, went to sell our vacation home, six bedrooms on top of a mountain jacuzzi. I mean, this is a really, really nice place. And I was surprised, and I was telling Michael that our house sold that fast because in my industry, if you watch the news and you listen to what we tell you on the news about the housing market, you know,
mm-hmm.
nobody's buying, this and that, yada, yada, and then, you know, you actually talk to, you know, your friends and family and people that are buying and selling, it was kind of like the two didn't match to me. So what
mm-hmm.
so what experts were telling us on the news wasn't what was really in reality, because a lot of people that I know, you know, they were putting their houses on their market like we did, I mean, they were selling really fast, because at one time I remember thinking, oh, it's probably going to take us like, you know, a year or 2 years to get
mm-hmm.
to turn this house over. Literally within, after we made a few of the corrections that they told us to, within 6 months, I mean, we had like four or five people that were really interested. I was completely shocked because in my head, Stephen, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a long process. It's going to take forever. So it was interesting how, you know, what we were told on television and from
mm-hmm.
what the experts were saying didn't match reality to me.
Well, a lot of times they speak nationally, you know, they speak averages and in general generalities. But what you're talking about, we call micro markets, where it's really knowing your area, your neighborhood, and exactly the dynamic, whether it's a seller's market, a buyer's market, or a market that's in between, which we call equilibrium. Now, on
mm-hmm.
Friday night on HGTV Selling LA is an episode where I sold a house last summer, and that was right before the tide started to turn. And in this particular situation, they were longtime friends, and they needed to get top dollar for this house because it was a retirement scenario moving to Sonoma. And so I was able to convince them, and they were also open to it, to completely renovate their kitchen, move out everything, and stage the house. And part of what we did is we took their home and turned it into a product.
Gotcha.
And that is really what it's about. It's about making your home and preparing it so that it appeals to a wide range of buyers so that you can get top dollar. Because at the end of the day, representing a seller is about getting them top dollar. And that's something that we do for our sellers. So that's also a very exciting creative process where you're collaborating with the seller. Not all sellers are open to doing that, but when you do have a seller that gets it and they're willing to go the extra mile and to spend $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 on staging, which is not always necessary, depends on what you need and exactly what you're trying to accomplish, but it's turning out a finished product, a package.
Well, that was the best thing. I'm telling you, what you're talking about was the best thing that ever happened to us. And like I said, it wasn't like I didn't consider it to be a lot of stuff and unreasonable that the woman was asking us to do. And, you know, in fact, some of it we were able to do ourselves. We didn't have to, you know, go outside to get somebody to do it, and we moved a few things here and there. But I'm telling you, it really made all the difference in the world. So now if I hear, you know, people kind of moan and groan, if a real estate agent comes in and makes suggestions and say, well, you know, get rid of this, move this around, and they're kind of saying, well, you know, I don't really want to do that. It's like, no, really, you need to do that. If you want this house to sell, then do it, because, you know, nobody wants to walk into your house and they're thinking about buying it and it's all cluttered up and looks like a little wildlife museum or something. Get that stuff out of there because you want to sell the house. So I do get a little frustrated. Michael and I, Stephen, talk when we watch these kind of shows, and we think people just have these crazy, you know, unrealistic expectations about what a price of a home should be and the carpet piping and this and that. So we're the type of people that will talk back to the TV.
Yeah, Aaron, and
I like that.
I'm gonna clarify this, Stephen. The home to which Victoria's talking about wasn't like a dumpy trailer on the side of a mountain in the Ozarks kind of a thing. It didn't sell for $3,800, you know. My point is, people with money will always have money for quality property and quality projects. So, you know, what is the worst house that you've ever encountered and thought when you walked in, I have no idea what I'm going to do here?
The worst house. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because I don't really necessarily look at it that way. I look at, okay, if a buyer's going to come into this house with the way it is, what is it worth as is?
Right.
So for me, it's about finding the right price point that is a value for the buyer. So if a house is in poor condition, or it, you know, is cluttered, or the seller's not willing to do very much to it to make it presentable, then the price needs to reflect that.
Right.
Because,
interesting,
you know, there's two things. You either have presentation or price. And if you can achieve both of those items and hit them both right, that's the winning combination.
Yeah.
So if your presentation is not great, then your price has to reflect that. And if
it seems your house can be
your house can be the most gorgeous house where you have spent thousands of dollars on staging and getting it right, but if you've priced it outside of the market, it's not going to sell. So it's that's the winning combination, presentation and accurate pricing. And, you know, one thing that I'm very grateful for is I have a lot of clients who are investors who also flip homes. And so I've had a tremendous amount of success and experience with actually making sure that my pricing is right on, because if it's not right on, that client's not going to come back to me, and that's never happened. So there's a lot of creativity that goes into preparing a home for sale. And when I say creativity, I don't necessarily mean paint. It's about understanding value. It's about a price strategy. Mm-hmm. Because your sales price is one thing, but your price strategy is something else. Do you price under market? Do you price at market? What range are you going to get the most traction? And today, with multiple offers and creating that auction environment here in Los Angeles, you have a little latitude with your pricing, where maybe 2 years ago, when the recession was in full force, it was really, really tough, and you had to make sure that you were spot on with it all, if not the house sat.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All very good points. You can find out all this good information at www.stephenarentrealtor.com. Stephen, we're running out of time with you. Congrats on 3 seasons of Selling LA and a 4th one coming up. I look forward to watching you.
Watch this Friday night. It's a great episode. The episode is called Big versus Small.
Big versus Small. Got it. My friend, thank you for taking the time out. Please say hi to Sherry Goldberg for me, and just huge love your way, buddy. Congrats.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephen. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. So again,
very,
guys,
very
make
good
sure
point.
You watch this week. Yes, yes, yes. And you know what I like about him? It's clear he knows his stuff. You can tell he's just not some face on television because he wants to be on TV to do a show. You know what I mean? Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've interviewed a lot of people, Michael, but you can kind of tell Stephen's very passionate about what he does, and he knows his stuff. So, again, thank you to Sherry for allowing him to come on our show to introduce us to our over, 275,000 listeners. Speaking of that, Michael, our audience just keeps growing and growing and growing. Amazing.
I know. And I love the fact that it's now at 1.6 million. So the 235 are just people who are subscribed to our page. So I'm very, very happy.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Absolutely. Not a problem. But anyways, Andy Crawford is waiting to go to bed. I know he's going to call in from his bed. So I see he's up in queue and everything. We're going to open with a little bit of Andy Crawford. This is Andy Crawford 13 Days. Brand new music to it, Almost Victorian. When we get back, Andy Crawford will be in the house. Don't go away.
Sleepless nights, since I feel the warmth of your skin, I lie awake and picture you there with him. When it should be you and me, it all plays out in my mind. You'll always be all that I need. Just search for me and you'll find. I'm lost in the dark, will I find your outstretched arms open wide? Wait for me when I'm falling behind.
Wait for me
when I'm falling behind.
Wait for me.
Crawford with 13 Days. Andy Crawford joining us from Bedside. Andy Crawford, thanks for making it back to At Home with Victoria.
Glad to be back.
Glad to have you, man. You've been very, very busy doing a lot of touring, I'm hearing.
I have been, yeah.
Where you been, man?
I've been playing a lot around Myrtle Beach lately. I'm back down there in a few weeks, play 14 shows in 7 days.
Wow, that's a lot. 13 Days is a great song. Any story behind that?
There's always a woman behind every song, right?
Well, absolutely, yeah. Are you single or are you married, buddy?
I am not married, but. I don't see it being very long.
Okay, sounds good. You played around with a friend of mine, Drew Stevens, a while back and stuff. What was it like playing with him?
Drew's a good guy, and I enjoyed meeting Mike too, his manager, Mike Cullen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good guys. Yeah, we had a good time.
Yeah, you had a good time. We had to send an APB out for Mike and Drew. They went missing in the lovely state of Nashville. The dogs were called out. It was a long story. And actually, the story of what had happened was actually quite boring, so I won't punish anybody with it. But well, you had us all scared, buddy. Absolutely. Vic, what did you think of 13 Days?
I like it. I like it a lot. I was just sitting here thinking that I know, Andy, you were talking about all the dates and being busy, and I know for your industry, summertime is really busy for you guys because I'm thinking about all the different festivals and concerts and all of those gigs that, you know, folks like you generally have coming up. And I wanted to know, does it ever get old for you when you're on that stage and then, you know, that applause comes and people start singing along, you know, your songs? Does that ever get old for you?
You know, it never really gets old for me. I can play the same song, you know, 200 times in a year, 300 times in a year. I hate to say it. No, I don't hate to say it. The music is as much about me as it is about who's listening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially with my original stuff, you know, that's kind of what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling put to music. So
gotcha.
That never gets old.
Yeah. Gotcha. When you're down in Myrtle Beach and stuff, Andy, is that a listening room or is that everybody's clanking around with their glasses and stuff?
That is actually. And it surprised me too. It's pretty much people are there to hear music.
That's good. Yeah.
It's here around where I am now. It's more of the people go out and get hammered, and if there happens to be music there, great.
Yeah.
But down there, you know, it seems to be the opposite.
Yeah. Andy, you're on Reverb Nation. You can go ahead and check all of his concert dates out at www.reverbnation.com/Andy Crawford. But I'm curious, are you planning on actually going over to Europe? There seems to be whispering through my little birds and bees.
No, not right now.
Not right now? No. My bees are liars. Liars, I tell you.
Liar bees.
Liar bees. Huge liar bees. However, let's go back to the music. This is one of my favorite songs of yours, Andy. It's a brilliant rendition of something that, you know, made someone millions, and I'm sure it's going to make you something. So this is Andy Crawford with Billie Jean. More with Andy Crawford when we get back.
From a movie screen, I said, "Oh, Mambo, what do you mean? I am the one who would dance on the floor and around." She said, "I am the one who would dance on the floor and around." She said, "Her name." Every head turned without the dream. Remember to always think twice.
Crawford with Billy Jean. Check him out at ReverbNation.com/Andy Andy Crawford. Andy, my friend, I know we had you on hold. I know we ran over with you, but I know you're getting tired. I know things are getting away from you. You're on Facebook as well at Andy Crawford. Are you on Twitter as well, buddy?
I don't do the Twitter thing.
No.
No, I'm just now getting the hang of Facebook.
I love how you'd like to keep it real, buddy. And you know what I have to say? Billie Jean is one of the best stripped down versions I've heard of that. I applaud the fact that you're an acoustic guy. You can really hear the passion in the songs, and you know, I really wish nothing but the best for you, man.
I appreciate that. I thank
Andy,
you guys
thank you.
For everything you've done for me. You know, if it wasn't for you guys, I sure wouldn't have. Sure would have been playing that show with Drew, or you know, hanging out with those guys. And I appreciate that,
buddy. We're just people who love talent. It's a no-brainer. But I do want to thank you for taking the time to call in tonight, and thank you for lending us all the great music. I've got "Meant to Be" coming up. We're going to close with that. But thanks for keeping us in your mind as well as you know, at Home of Victoria is your home too. So anytime you get stuff in
thanks,
the hopper,
Andy.
Buddy, come on back.
Bye bye.
Thank you, guys.
You take care, man. Have a good night. The lovely, talented music of Andy Crawford. Vic, my friend,
yeah,
you've got a good show coming up tomorrow.
I know, yeah.
Good show too.
I know. What's interesting about the show tomorrow is that as soon as we're done with this show, I have to switch over, and so do you and all of our listeners, to HGTV, because Lyselle Taylor is going to be on House Hunters. So we've got to watch her at 10 o'clock, and then she'll be on tomorrow night at 8 o'clock to talk about her experience on the show tonight and to talk about the couple and, you know, what sort of went into doing that. And I mentioned at the top of the hour when the show started was that I do have a friend of mine that I used to work in television news with named Jamie. And Jamie is now in PR. I think she works at one of the hospitals in Boston. So I emailed her to see if she can call in tomorrow to sort of give us a sense of what it's like being in Boston during this time right now as a result of the bombing, because I'm thinking that if she works at one of the major hospitals, I'm sure that her hospital probably got some of the injured who came there. And I also do know that Jamie in the past has gone to some of the marathons. So it'll be interesting to sort of get an actual, you know, firsthand experience or account on our show of someone that lives there and who is actually there for it. So I'm going to work on that. So that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.
Absolutely. Want to thank everybody up in chat today. Goofy Boyne, thanks for joining us. All the new guests, guest 4613, guest 8169, and all of the other ones. And also to our guest tonight, John Birch, Stephen Aaron, check them out on HGTV Selling LA, and Andy Crawford on Reverb Nation. Vic, great show, and we're going to play out with a little bit more of Andy Crawford. So I'll see you tomorrow at 8 o'clock.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
Because it was cool, but it meant something to me. It was the first tractor that we owned, John Deere. Holes in my jeans, Maverick style, hauling wood back from the old dump. And it's warm all winter night. Help out, sign of a farmer's farm. I'm on the front porch shouting, the covers on. Talking about home. I'm riverbank. Georgia Peach, so sweet. Florida sun, summer fun. Fly away, sweet Caroline. Take your country in Tennessee. Bluegrass country. Old Peach, a few times early light. Talking about home, hot windows. Shout the name if you got it in you. Raise your glass. Since you were 16, grab a plate, pull up a chair.